Today is July 17th, 2019. This is part two of a Grand Canyon oral history with Emma Beninati. Emma spells her name E-M-M-A-B-E-N-E-N-A-T-I. My name is Tom Martin, and this interview is conducted at our kitchen table. Emma, thank you very much for your willingness to chat today on part two of this Grand Canyon history. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Great. Last time we wrapped up with you recounting some of the amazing hikes that you did in Grand Canyon in the 1980s, and you were talking about a number of explorations that you did up in Marble Canyon, which was rare at the time. And one of the questions I had for you was, were you aware of any other women hikers up in Marble Canyon hiking, doing the kind of hikes you were doing at the time?
No, I wasn't, but I am. Those hikes, I either did them with a group, and actually they were mostly affiliated with Sierra Club. You know, I'd get to know a leader, and then the leader would put together a private trip, and then they'd call up people. And in that group, there were women.
Like who? Do you remember their names at all?
I can't.
Okay.
I can't remember. They were friends. Actually, yeah, so that's how those sort of hikes happened. And like, for example, this, a person I did several hikes with was Bert Fingerhut, who is a very wealthy financier from New York City, who I imagine wanted to give back something, because he invested, if I remember correctly, in Xerox, and I forget, FedEx, and that's where he made his millions. And then he moved out to Aspen. He was also the one involved in the bank fraud. But aside from that, he contributed to Sierra Club and other nonprofits, and so I kind of knew him through Sierra Club, and so what he'd do, you know, because of his connections, is he would find out who the local experts were, because I did a hike with him in Death Hollow, and he finds the local renowned experts, and then he gets them somehow, you know, I don't know if he paid him or whatever, and then they would come along on the trip, or they would advise him. So I mean, he's done that with Southwestern, more kind of reticent people who don't want to be in the limelight but know a tremendous amount, and he somehow connects with them.
Interesting.
And so yeah, so that's how, so while I was kind of with his group and hiking, I did some pretty cool hikes, and the one, like the Shinumu to 29 Mile to Eminence with Stan Steck and his son, wait, Stan, George Steck, and then his son Stan came in and visited us and then hiked back out. Stan was a ranger somewhere when he kind of popped in and visited us.
So 29 Mile to Eminence, the 29 Mile Canyon, this is the trail that goes in the reclamation trail built at the fence fault for the Marble Canyon dam site work? Is
we
that
did,
right?
We did pass that, like that. We passed that after a day or two.
Okay.
But so we came in, you know, we drove off of 89 or 89A on the res, and then went right in 29 Mile.
Mm-hmm.
And and I think it was maybe the second night, possibly, or the third night, where we ended up at the dam site where they drilled.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That was a very cool hike.
So you're on top of the red wall.
Yeah.
All the way down to Eminence, and then out there.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, what a nice loop.
Yeah.
The one trouble with that is, where'd you find water?
We went down to the river every night.
Okay.
And we did some, like Shinumu, it's really close to the river, and then
But from there
yeah, every night,
downstream.
yeah, so like at the dam site, right near Redwall Cavern, and George knew another way the night before to,
There's the pin route that goes
yeah, that's what we
down
took.
there. Okay, all right.
That's what we took. That was pretty cool. We
Okay.
had kind of webbing rigged up, and we went right down the
Right down
limestone
that
face.
sloping
Yep.
limestone face.
Yeah.
And then further south from there, you would go past the Marble Canyon Dam site and the little camp at the top of that. But then water would have had to come out of potholes because you don't get down to the river.
There was another route George knew that we got
Really?
down.
Tadahatsu?
That sounds
Maybe?
familiar,
Okay.
but I remember everyone was climbing involved.
Or the Bridge of Sighs.
Yeah,
But that's not.
that's on the other side, isn't it?
Well, the Redwall breakdown is on River Left. There's the bridges on River Right on the west side, but you guys are on the east side, and there's a walk down to the river there.
Then
So yeah, okay.
it was a scrambly thing that we did each time. And then at
Okay.
Eminence we went down to the river as well.
Okay, to get water before you went up.
And we actually camped at the river.
Oh wow.
And then we took this wrong route out because, oh no, George took the right route, but the leader of the hike, Bert, he sent us right up the gully, and
This
we
is Bert Fingerhut?
yeah he
Okay.
said he and it was awful.
Oh
And
yeah,
then
you can't get out that way. Oh no.
there's George on the horizon on the correct, and but of course, we're like, Bert was our leader, so we followed him up this
Oh my
heinous
gosh.
gully. And yeah,
What can you tell me about George Steck?
he was of very nice. He did get mad a couple times at Bert because, like, Bert would insist on doing something or doing something his way, and not listen to Bert where I mean, not listen to George, where I'm sure George knew better because, the canyon was his like second home. But he was just, easy to get along with. I remember he every day he made a quart of instant coffee. I think he had. Like, so he instant coffee and some kind of creamer, powder probably, and sugar. And he mixed that up and he would drink that. Like, that was something he really looked forward to.
Okay.
Yeah, cold.
All right.
And,
His refreshment, his chill
yeah,
refreshments.
well,
Okay.
yeah, and
I
it
mean,
was just like,
it wasn't
cold,
cold, but yeah.
regular water.
Yeah.
And he had a dry sense of humor
Okay.
and was not a bragging man at all for all his experience. He was
Okay.
very, I don't, he was not like always speaking for everybody to hear at all. And he probably should have spoke more, like, I don't know if everyone in the group really recognized the significance of him there, but yeah, he was just like a member of our group.
Nice.
Yeah.
So he was typically doing the route finding, and he knew
Yeah,
where
or
all
he knew
the
where, yeah,
down routes were.
exactly. He
Okay.
knew exactly. And
Who else was on those trips? Do you remember?
I don't. It
Okay.
was just this kind of, there was this, Bert had some groupies that always were following him.
Okay.
And somehow I got asked on the trip too. But.
So at this point, being a child of Detroit, what was the Grand Canyon teaching you and telling you?
Let's see. At this point, I was in love with Grand Canyon, and I wanted to go as many places as I could within the confines of my job, work. And I always said whenever I would go into it or go there that Grand Canyon always teaches me a lesson. And just either a lesson on life or a lesson on being in the outdoors or a lesson on camping. But I can't, I don't know if I could say one now. It's just like, oh, I should have done this, or this is how I should have planned, or this is how the route I should have. There's always something to be learned. And yeah.
Did your time on your hikes in Grand Canyon help you in school to be a better teacher in Phoenix when you would leave the canyon and go back to work?
Well, I it probably gave me a refreshed attitude about life and work for sure, definitely. And I maybe would t put into my lessons, t about nature or something, but I still wasn't at that point. I really wasn't an activist or an advocate for nature. I was gonna say, like, compared to today, things were a lot calmer then. There wasn't as many people. But somebody who had hiked in the canyon, say in the 50s or something, would probably say, "Oh my God, we're in the 80s now. It's really horrible." But, and that's that base thing. Like, I came into it in the canyon in, say, the 80s. And so that was my base. And so it seemed fine. Now I think, "Oh my God, it's a zoo." But it's like people coming, say, to Flagstaff, they think, "Oh, Flagstaff is great." Well, I think it's a zoo. And I'm like, "You don't know what it used to be like." And they say, "Yeah, I think this is great." So it's just interesting how everybody's base level, which is kind of worrisome, because if everybody's base level keeps getting worse and they accept that, we're never going to get better. Or, and then there's also people who say you can't return to what it was in the past, but I don't think I agree with that. With the conservation and the overpopulation and everything.
Well, this is a
So.
fascinating question for you because the national parks are built on an act of Congress called the Organic Act, and you know this, which has a basis of non-impairment for future generations. And that concept of non-impairment, in theory, doesn't change no matter what the population is. So when the people in 1954 were writing about the increased number of river runners and were concerned about it then, we think about non-impairment. And so today, it's not that the population has increased by three or four. That non-impairment mandate still holds true. When do you think you became aware of the non-impairment mandate? Just simply for thinking about the structure of the national park as a way to sort of start building a foundation for resource protection or environmental awareness.
I became aware. This kind of leads into it, because so I was doing a bunch of backpacking, and then and I was a teacher, and I learned about this class called the Geology and Ecology of Grand Canyon, taught by Stan Buse, who was Mr. Geology of NAU, and I mean he was the geology department.
He wrote the book.
He wrote the book. And Steve Carruthers were the professors of that course, and I saw it in the NAU catalog, and I thought, cool, I get to go on a river trip on this class.
So this would be a summer course, okay?
For and mostly where there were educators in there, and it was a 6-week course. And what I didn't realize was that we would, I saw the river trip. But I didn't realize we would get a huge amount of fabulous information on ecology and geology of Grand Canyon.
Wow.
And that's kind of where I actually fell in love with geology from that course.
And this was what year, do you remember?
88.
So the summer of 1988? Okay. What do you remember about Stan?
Oh, he was soft-spoken. Very knowledgeable, but not a pontificator. He was. I always said he sounded like a preacher. His voice was very soothing, and when he would talk and lecture, he was a good sport. Like when we'd go on the river trip with him, I did this class twice, 88 and 89. And we had like Brian Durker was on there and Pete Resnick, Weir Boatman, and they would tease Dr. Buse. We called him Dr. Buse. They would tease him or they'd do something to his camp, and he was always so good natured, you know, he would always take the teasing real well. Yeah.
And what do you remember about Steve Carruthers?
Steve was very charismatic, and very knowledgeable, and more opinionated, or you know, like he would tell us opinionated. Yeah, well, there's some, maybe there's not as much to be opinionated with geology, because, but you know, he, with the ecology and stuff. Yeah, he was fun, and we learned a lot from Steve. In fact, Steve was on my committee for my PhD.
Ah, okay. So tell me more about that first trip in the summer. Well, tell me about the whole class.
The class.
Summer
so
of
the
68.
That class.
Sorry, 1988.
88 is one of my best memories because it was at NAU, and NAU is probably, you know, only 13,000 students. And we stayed in a dorm, and we would walk down the Center Mall to that, to the geology building. That, you know, it's the old geology building that's attached to biology. And I just love that. It's the physics and astronomy geology building. I love that building. I love the history in it. And I remember inside it was cool and kind of dim, and we'd meet in there. Every day we'd have class, and then we'd usually go on a field trip in the afternoon. We went all over northern Arizona, you know,
wow,
to cinder craters, to parks. Yeah, it was fabulous. It was field and lecture, and then the culmination of the trip was the river trip. It was a 12-day river trip. And then we all had projects we had to do, because the purpose of this was each of us had a project, and we'd write up a report, and then we would submit it to the national park. Like some people studied beach erosion, some people studied wildlife along the rivers, some people studied like rock layers or sand layers, or these were ongoing topics that they had that they'd done for years, and so people would either contribute to them or maybe do something a little different. And then we'd write it up.
And what did you do?
I can't remember my first years, but my second year in 89 I did, you know, the first year I did like lizard, you know, wildlife along the river. Steve Carruthers was in charge of that. And the second year I did human impact, or it was tamarisk, the tamarisk and its allelopathy. And then that, Larry Stevens was the ecology professor on that. Steve Carruthers was on our trip in a boatman in 89, but he didn't have time, I think, to teach. In fact, that was when he was just getting his SWCA rolling. Like, he was growing bigger and bigger, as we know.
And this is the Southwest, CA stands for...
Oh, it's Stephen W. Carruthers and Associates,
sorry,
SWCA.
Which is a company that he founded,
mm-hmm,
to do archaeological censusing of project sites before, you know, like roads are built,
yeah,
or construction is,
yeah,
built.
Yeah, basically, his environmental company did environmental surveys in order to provide permits for development.
Okay.
In general.
Right. So in 1989, you were looking at the impacts of tamarisk with Larry Stevens.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember about Larry?
Larry was also, you know, kind of reticent, but clearly confident, had a tremendous amount of information to share. And I mean, it's fabulous fun to be around him because he's just full of information and facts and stuff.
And very easy to share that information.
And he, like, as soon as it was kind of funny, because so there was like two big 37-foot boats, and then Larry, of course, would not sit on a motorboat, although he did in the future when we did river trips, research trips. But he, of course, had his own 18-foot rowboat. So it's kind of funny, there was this big boat, and then there's Larry. And at first, nobody wanted to be on that rowboat, because it was all splashy. And so then there was like a group of four of us that went on Larry's boat. And then as the trip went on, everybody wanted to be on Larry's boat. And we'd be like, oh no, we're
You
on,
lost your chance.
this is our place. Oh, we're gonna have some big rapids today. You wouldn't want to be on it. So I think we almost dominated his boat for the whole trip. Yeah, but that was.
The boatman you mentioned, Pete Resnick and Brian Durker, was this were they chartered motors or were they Park Service boats? Do you remember? Were they NAU boats or Carruthers boats?
Gosh, I don't remember. I think, actually, as I think about it, I think they were snouts, and they were Carruthers' snouts.
Okay, so they were 22 foot long. That makes sense.
Because this was probably under a research permit. I know Stan Buse had a grant. I forget where it was from. I mean, in Washington, some big grant for education purposes, and so was it probably a research permit, which meant they used their own boats.
That makes sense. All right.
But it was on this, so that, as newcomers to Flagstaff, of course, we were still living in Phoenix, teaching, and we were fortunate, I think, to be introduced to sort of the core group of Flagstaff, Colorado River runners, Brian Durker, Steve Carruthers, Stan Buse, Pete Resnick.
What do you remember about Brian?
He was a ton of fun. He has a very loud presence, He's a big man, and God, it was just fun being around him. And yeah, it was. He may. I mean, he. I feel like he and Pete and Steve Carruthers also made the trip fabulous, being around them.
And Pete Resnick, what can you say about Pete?
He was just nice, a gentleman, friendly. Everybody sort of dims when Brian Durker is around. Like, you just kind of fade in the background of Brian Durker.
It's easy to do.
You can't compete with that. But so it was on those trips, the second trip. Where we were, I think we were at Grapevine, or could have been Grapevine, because there is a place to hike in there, kind of sketchy. And Dave Wegner hiked in and told us that Secretary of the Interior Manuel Lujan has decided that we're going to do an environmental impact statement on the Colorado River, and money is going to be coming, and he kind of invited us to participate or work on it or study, you could get your master's degree. And so that sort of changed the trajectory of my life, and Joe's life, because we were both teaching, and I really was pretty happy, but we saw this opportunity.
So you were on a track to get your master's anyway as a teacher,
No,
no?
no.
Okay.
No. I think I, because of this, I did. I got a master's in earth science under Stan Buse
Okay.
because of these because of these classes. And
was that a totally a didactic master's? Did you have to actually have to do research at all, paper?
I had to do a oral presentation, oral exam, oral. I didn't. There was not a master's thesis with this. It was
okay.
An oral.
All right.
Exam/presentation.
Uh huh. And what did you focus on?
I focused on deserts, landforms in deserts. I just talked about like the formation of the Western United States and the landforms.
Here are the Rocky Mountains, here's the Pacific Ocean, here's the land in between, and here's how it got that way?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And just
which
like,
is still being debated today.
Yeah. I may have set an older hypothesis on how Grand Canyon was formed.
Hmm.
But since that class with Stan, I have been fascinated with geology.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
But then we moved. So after that, Joe and I moved. We moved from Phoenix teaching to Flagstaff. And
did you then, when you went back for your master's? So.
And it was something I could do from Phoenix. Like I just took classes. I worked with Stan Buesen. Actually, his cohort, he was a teacher from Missouri. I can't think of his name. Frank, I can't think of his last name. But he helped me put together a program.
So driving back and forth?
No, just helped me design the classes. And so I took classes at NAU. I took classes at ASU.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in other words, I didn't have to be on campus.
Okay.
To...
Let's back up a minute. Can you tell me about David Wegener? And that's W-E-G-N-E-R.
Yeah, Dave Wegener. So we got to know Dave. So I just met him. I was like, oh, who's this tall, skinny, blonde guy telling us about this EIS and what's an EIS? But then when we decided to move to Flagstaff, which was very scary because I had to leave my job, and we started to work for GCES, Glen Canyon Environmental Studies, and I was doing surveys through GCES, which Dave Wegener was in charge of. He was the director, the Bureau of Reclamation director of that program. And they were in that office down on Birch, you know, that six or seven story building.
It was
so
the federal building, with the FBI on the same floor. Downtown Flagstaff was the tallest building in Flagstaff at the time.
But he
set up shop there.
Uh huh. Yeah, and I don't know when. I mean, they had been going. Glen Canyon Environmental Studies had been going since like when the 70s or how old is that? I should know because I gave a talk on this and I wrote a little monograph for the Grand Canyon historical presentation stuff. So it's in my article.
Okay.
I just don't have it. but anyway, Dave, so I got to know Dave because I was doing, because I got onto research, river flow research trips. Remember they were running the crazy flows, and then they'd go down to 5,000 CFS, and then we go down and we'd measure the erosion on the beaches.
So let's flesh that out a little bit more. This was a study to look at flow releases from Glen Canyon Dam and different flow releases, very high, very low, very quick, very slow.
Uh-huh.
Lots of low steady, lots of high steady, in between steady, and then those flows would run for 5 days or 7 days, and then a team of people would amass into the canyon.
Mm-hmm.
boats would go down empty to Phantom Ranch where people would hike in and join them, and then those boat crews, some would race forward and then start surveying assigned specific beaches on a 1 or 2 week basis.
Yes.
For months.
Yes.
And how did that go?
How did it go? Let me think. Because, you know, at the time, I still didn't quite get the big picture. I realized that the dam has an effect on the downstream resources, but I'm still like, oh, this is my job. I'm doing river trips every 2 weeks.
They were fun. I mean, you got to see the canyon and sort of go from beach to beach and set up a total station, a survey station. And someone would run around with a rod and you'd shoot in a bunch of sights and watch the sand disappear.
Yes. And I think we did, I mean, it was determined that the flows out of the dam definitely had an effect on the deterioration of the beaches. But yeah, I was often, there were four segments of the canyon, and I was always on the, I was always in Marble Canyon. I remember I'd ask, can I go into the lower canyon? But they'd say, oh no, we have the team set up, you know, you have to stay with, which really I grew to love Marble Canyon, but I think I was the very upper part from Glen Canyon down to 40 Mile or something.
So you guys would show up at Lee's Ferry and then go upstream into Motor Snout boats.
Yeah.
Start your surveys up there and then go right past Lee's Ferry and continue surveying downstream to 40 Mile.
40 or something. I haven't thought about it in a long time. And then we'd go out at Phantom and then we'd hike out.
Okay.
But I was in a lower part where I think we hiked in and we went down the river, you know, very fast so that we could get to the fourth section that ended at Diamond Creek.
Okay.
So,
were you running total station? Were you running the rod? What were you doing?
A couple times I did the total station just because I wanted to learn how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But the geologists, you know, the people like the people getting master's degrees or maybe people who already had one would generally run the total station.
That wasn't you though? I'm confused in the timeline. So you hadn't started your master's yet?
I did my master's in, yeah, I had started it. I did my master's like in 90 to 92.
Okay.
So I was, yeah. It wasn't really structured like a normal master's thesis master's was, because I was taking classes and just preparing this presentation.
Okay.
So, yeah. So I ran the rod, you know, there's a whole bunch of other stuff you could have done besides run the total stations, but those trips were pretty cush because we had we had Steve Bledsoe, you know, and Cindy Bledsoe, she's probably changed her last name, but and they were all oars boatmen, and we had the oars menu, like we would have shrimp, we would have filet mignon, we would have, you know, because they were just following their usual procedure for their commercials. It wasn't until a couple years in where oars figured out, hey, we could make a lot more money or conserve money if we just served them regular tacos. So, but for the first part of that research, we were eating fabulous food. It was cooked for us. You know, we just had to...
Who was the cook?
Always a cook.
Okay.
Always a cook, always a boatman. And then we just, and I mean, we'd help in the kitchen, but pretty much we were just doing our work. And then when food was ready, we'd go eat. And I remember like the 5,000 CFS was tricky to run. I remember once we were at Hans and it was like horrible. And Steve Bledsoe was scouting on the left bank. And I remember I was just learning how to row a boat then. And I remember I went up, I mean, you should never talk to a boatman scouting. And I went up to him and I just said something like, wow, that looks really bad. I can't see a way through. And, you know, anybody else would have said, you know, get out of here. But he's just such a gentleman. He always was. And we ripped a big hole in the boat And he's all calm, and he pulls over below Hans, and he fixes the rip. We just hung out there for a couple hours. Like, that was just how Steve operated. Yeah.
That's good. So you pick up the pieces, you carry on.
Right.
Yeah.
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 And I remember one time there was a Release Ferry Ranger, Vic. Can't think of his last name. Vic. But he went once we when we got we went in to start, he was there. It was a very cold morning, probably in the early winter, and he showed up with these coffee thermoses and a whole bunch of pastries. And I forget his wife's name at the time. They're not married now. She was fun. And he goes, "Oh, whatever her name was, she made this for you." And it was just like fabulous pastries and these
Oh my
cakes.
gosh.
And the coffee was, like French roast. It was good stuff. And so later, after Natasha was his wife's name, and later after we talked to Natasha, we're like, "Oh, thank you for making those treats for us." And she said, "I didn't make them. Vic is the baker. He made them. He was just too embarrassed to tell you that he made them." Like, that was so sweet.
Huh.
Yeah.
Nice. What else do you remember about those trips?
Oh, they were fun. We did our work. And there, people got along. It was pretty nice.
Did you get it? Did you see? Did you appreciate right then and there that it was a losing game with the sand?
No,
Okay.
I didn't. No, not at all. I didn't get any of that. I didn't get it until I started my PhD. And I started working for Dean Blinn's lab, and then they were doing the aquatic food base, the algae and the bugs. And Dean, another fabulous, fabulous professor and mentor.
What time, when, a timeline? So you finished your master's in 92, and then did you go right into your PhD then?
No, so let's see. So I was still teaching up until then. I took a year
In
off.
Phoenix.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I had taken a year off, and actually during that year, 90, Larry Stevens was doing a research trip, and he asked me if I'd want to go. He asked a few people. A month-long research trip from mid-January to mid-February. And I thought, "Oh yeah, that sounds great." So I took a year's leave of absence from teaching. And
What did you do on that trip?
oh my God. We did surveying. We dug holes, we got tree cores. Larry had so many projects, But yeah, we dug into the beach to see like the layers of probably from flows. We surveyed with total stations. We checked out pack rat midden. We cored so many hackberry trees to determine if they were water stressed during the dam years compared to before. And Larry told us everything to get. It was a two boat trip,
Wow.
and Jeff Aronson was the other boatman. And he told us like what we needed, but he told us to wear those silly river neoprene booties in January. I was ready to hike out up a cliff and leave the trip. And then there was this really nice, I think he was a geologist who had like size 10 men's irrigation boots, and he left. He goes, "You can have my boots." And I was just clomping around in those things, but they saved me
Yeah.
because I mean, Larry was warm rowing with his neoprene booties on, but I was dying. So that saved me. I learned a lot about having your feet in water all day.
Yes.
And Larry worked us like he was, he worked us all day and into the dark to the point where I used to set my alarm on my watch and it would just go off. We'd still be on the river and he'd be like, "Oh, "Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I guess we better pull over pretty soon and camp."
There was an audio clip of Larry Stevens going through volunteers. And the question was, "Larry, you seem to go through a lot of volunteers." The answer was, "Yes, I do. Is it like this?" Ah! "Next volunteer?" "No, it wasn't like that. It was like this." Ah! 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 Until they were like, "I quit."
Yeah.
And then the next volunteer would show up. It was hard work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he's, yeah.
But you got a lot done.
Yeah, I think we did.
And you learned a lot.
I learned a lot, and
Nice.
it was fun because he had work to do, and I think Jeff Aronson had meetings. And so when we got to Phantom Ranch, he had to go out for a week.
Oh.
And so we didn't want to leave or didn't want to go back to Phoenix. So we camped at, dang, what's the name of that beach that has three camps that everybody camps at the night before?
Cremation?
Cremation.
Mm-hmm.
We camped there, and we just us, Joe and I, for the whole week, and we called it our vacation within our vacation.
Nice.
And then in the
So, did
middle,
you have a little boat you could row across and go down to
yes,
Phantom and come
and you
back
know,
and.
neither of us knew how to row really, and Joe was he and Larry showed him how to row across so we could get, because we would go to Phantom and we would hang out in the ranger station.
Ooh.
But then in the very middle of that, we got reservations on the South Rim. We stayed up there for
Wow.
a 2 or 3 days. And so we called it our vacation within our vacation within our vacation, if you
Wonderful.
get
Yeah.
that. So that was fun.
Nice. Were there, did you see any other river runners down there then?
I don't think so.
January
I don't think so.
1990.
1990, mid
Ah.
January to mid February. I mean, maybe there was a motor trip of someone, but I don't
Some other
recall.
science trip going by and.
Yeah, but I just don't recall.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very fun. And so then week goes by and new crew of people come in with
Yeah.
Larry or same crew.
Larry and Jeff came back, and I
Okay.
think they had one other or two other people at the most. We were a very small group.
Wow.
Yeah. Probably because everybody knew it was Larry's trip and they're not going to
What else? Well, what can you tell me about Jeff Aronson? And that's spelled JeffAronson. What else do you remember about Jeff?
He was a nice person, seemed like he had a lot of world experience. I think at that time he said he was recovering from having cancer or something. He was like on the mend and getting back in shape and you know getting physical again, and he did fine everything, you know. Yeah.
Nice. And then for the lower half of that trip, again, more studies, more research, more
Yeah.
heading up probably tributaries that had flowing water to look at ecology, possibly, I'm not sure.
Yeah, just still coring of hackberry trees. Of course, they petered out.
Right.
Surveying, looking at pack rat middens. Dang, I can't remember, but we were busy every day, of course.
Okay, at this time in 1990, so this is your year off. You haven't started your master's yet, or had you?
I probably started it and was applying like classes, my geology and ecology of Grand Canyon classes and other classes I took at ASU. I was again, you know, amassing my classes then.
Okay, so taking requirements, starting to
Yeah.
pull those together.
Yeah.
What can you tell me about Dean Blinn? That's Blinn.
Yes. So the way I met Dean was he was Joe's advisor because Joe has tremendous water background. And so when this became apparent that there was going to be huge studies and lots of funding coming to NAU, probably Larry probably told Joe, to talk to Dean Blinn, that he could get a master's with him. And so we met Dean Blinn, and so Joe started his master's with Dean in probably 90. And so he had an a lab, he had a lab. Dean actually, he wrote grants. Dean got over $1 million in grants, which back in the early 90s, that's a lot of money for research. He was a very, he was a quiet man, extremely knowledgeable, a great teacher, fun to be with, soft spoken. You know, he was a great teacher, a great researcher, a great mentor, which is extremely rare in academia, I can tell you from direct experience. And he was all three of those things. And so I started working in his lab, and I couldn't find a teaching job in Flagstaff. You know, I was like, you know, and I didn't know what to do because I quit my job. You know, it was actually a pretty stressful time for me. And so he let me work in the lab. You know, I was weighing algae and sorting bugs and that kind of thing. And he said, "Well, why don't you get a PhD with me?" I mean, he just took me on, and so I did. I said, "Okay, well, that would be a job." So I started a PhD with Dean. Actually, I was still terrestrial. You know, I wanted to. I had this fascination with sky islands in the park, and so Dean said, "Well, let's put together a study where we study the potholes and see what's in there." And then so I wrote a couple grants of because we needed a helicopter to get to them. And I wrote a couple grants, and I remember I always go to the what we called the CPSU, the Colorado Plateau Research. I don't know what the U standed for, but it was on campus. It was in this decrepit, like, industrial building.
Union?
Yeah, even though we called it station, CPSU. So we'd go
Okay.
there, and there was park people there, and I remember talking to Linda Jalbert, who was the wilderness manager, and I would say, like, here's my grant proposal, and you know, potholes. And Dean was like, he was all in. It didn't, you know, he was just always like, whatever it is, I'll be with you for the study.
Wow.
And so I kept rewriting it and looking up stuff, and gave it to Linda Jalbert, and I forget the other plant woman, Warren, Kathy Warren was her.
Yes, Kathy Warren.
And Linda finally, she's like, sits back in her chair and kind of sighs and goes, oh, like, this is never gonna get approved. Like, it's like she finally had to break it to me. Like, you need to stop this because this is never gonna get approved. Helicopters flying onto sky islands is never gonna get approved. And so she just made me realize, oh, you know, thankfully she said that. So I stopped, and then I just did. I joined Dean, what Dean was doing with the algae and the food base and the effects of the flows on that.
Did it not occur to you that you could reach potholes without helicopters?
Well, but it would have been, yeah, climbing or something. That, but Dean, I want Dean wanted to be there.
And when when I think about potholes, I think about, again, for the
He we were
people
looking at
listening, what's a pothole?
pothole is a little depression in the rock where it fills with either rainwater or snow water, and living things are in it.
Are they everywhere? Where do you find them?
Well, they're like little crustaceans or you know, small invertebrate animals that can go into cyst form, and they come out. You know, they can go into cyst form and survive for months until water comes again.
So these potholes, they would dry out,
Yeah.
and the little creatures in the water would be able to survive the
Yeah.
drying, and then it would rain or it would snow, and the pothole would fill up, and the little creatures would come back to
Yeah.
life. Okay, where would I go to find one if I wanted to go find a pothole?
The slick rock.
What's a slick rock?
Slick rock is rock. A rock layer like sandstone or limestone, that's, you know, hard rock. That so you go where a rock is exposed, like not where vegetation is.
Okay. So it's basically where rainwater would collect
Yeah.
on a rock surface in a little pool or a pond?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And I can't, you know, I mean, I haven't thought of this in almost 30 years. I think what Dean was curious about was, are they different from each other? Are
Right.
the species different from each other? So that's
Right.
why it had to be sky islands that were not really accessible, and where, like, the easiest and quickest way,
Right.
and definitely for Dean, because he was not a,
How old was he at the time?
he was probably 50, late 50s
Okay.
or 50s, 50, somewhere in the 50s, and you know, he wasn't going to climb.
Okay.
And so,
When I think of potholes, I think of
oh, you think of deep
the
ones?
Esplanade, which is a rock formation name, where there's acres and acres of very few plants and mostly smooth rock. And they form lots of potholes. And you got to hike. It takes a day or two to get down into these areas where they are. But there's lots of them.
But for, I know we were specifically interested in sky islands that were
Okay.
sequestered from each other.
So like Wutan's Throne and Fishtail Mesa, just trying to throw out a couple of
I
Sky
can't even
Island,
think
Powell
of names.
Plateau.
Or anywhere that's not really accessible by
Okay.
animals, you know, it's very difficult. Like,
Okay.
and so in that case, there might not be as many as one would think, because they
Right.
cannot, they have to be like almost standing alone.
If you wanted to shear off the animal population, you're talking about places like Horus Temple, which has a couple of acres surrounded by sheer cliffs.
Yeah, that's
Okay.
what the aim was for.
Got it. All right.
And
Okay. So Linda Jalbert, Kathy Warren, these women were working in the Science Center. Did you interface with them here in Flagstaff or up
Yeah,
at the South
in
Rim?
Flagstaff
Okay.
at the Colorado Plateau Research Station
Okay.
thingy. So
And so that didn't sound like it was going to work.
yeah. Thank goodness Linda just blurted out, "Look, you need to stop this."
Oh.
So I stopped, because I was looking up stuff and trying to write proposals, and so she's helped me to stop that, because it was going to
Okay.
go nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah. The superintendent at the time, I want to say, was Rob Arnberger.
Yeah, him or, yeah, who followed Dick Marks? Did he follow Dick Marks?
He did, but there were a series of superintendents before he showed up between Marks and Arnberger.
Okay. I can't remember.
It was a
And
short
I was
time.
I because I wasn't even thinking, like, I didn't really, you know, I was just clueless.
Okay.
You know, about like this, you know, about getting approved for this intrusion into the wilderness, and this, like, the superintendent and approving it. I didn't
Okay.
know.
So went back to Dean, and Dean said, okay, we'll regroup and we'll study what?
So I studied the effects of the river, the dam operations on the downstream food base. And so it was bugs, algae, like filamentous algae, green algae, and diatoms.
Okay.
So that's what we
And
did.
was Joe doing a similar type?
Joe, he was studying the invertebrates, the insects.
Okay.
So his was very bug centric. Mine was very, I didn't want to do bugs. So he was looking at bugs. I forgot the name of his
So he was
dissertation.
looking at bugs in the air, you were looking at bugs in the water. Well, no,
No,
because
I wasn't really
diatoms
looking
are
at bugs at all.
not,
Bugs were
okay.
just like a part of it. Like, I maybe named some in biomass, but Joe was looking at species throughout the
So
corridor.
you're looking at the food base for the
Yeah,
bugs.
yeah.
Got it.
And then,
Algae and the diatoms, the things the bugs eat. Okay.
And then he was looking at stuff that the fish ate. I mean, the insects,
Okay.
invertebrates,
All right.
and how they were different in the corridor versus the tributaries. You know, how the tributaries were still a natural environment, and the corridor was completely an alien environment.
Alien environment
Alien
because of.
because of the change in the dam, the operations. The dam changed the Grand Canyon forever in terms of sediment, temperature, flows,
Flotsam, jetsam, the whole driftwood concept, the food base, the entire.
Yeah. You know, there's a loss of sediment. The flows were now completely unnatural. The temperature was steady instead of changing from basically freezing to 80 degrees. And so all the life reproduction needs for the natural invertebrates, the native invertebrates, was gone. So then the non-natives came in.
Okay.
And the lack of sediment allowed algae to grow, which normally, you know, I mean, the river corridor used to be like this depauperate sand canal, no vegetation, nothing really. Well, there was the humpback chub, and there were invertebrates accustomed to muddy water, but there was actually a ton of life there. That, you know, a lot of the Bureau of Rec people would be like, oh, there's nothing in the river. You know, there's nothing there. There's no bugs or anything. And then we'd say, well, you know, what do you think the fish are eating? And they'd say, oh, they're eating other fish. And we'd just tear our hair out like, well, what do you think the other fish are eating? You know, duh.
And the mayfly blooms and just these incredible populations of bugs that would work on the water, in the water. Yeah.
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 So.
Hmm.
So I got involved with that study.
Okay. And then that would become your master's.
My PhD.
Your PhD, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so that would have gotten you on the river, I would assume, quite a bit for sample collecting. Were those trips run out of the GCEIS?
Yes.
Glen Canyon Environmental, no, GCES.
Yeah.
Glen Canyon Environmental Studies.
Mm-hmm.
Shop,
mm-hmm.
or did you guys have your own boats?
No.
NAU have their own
no.
Navy?
We did everything through ORS,
okay.
You know, which was through GCES. And I went on a lot of river trips. Most of them were Joe's river trips.
Okay.
Mine, because my studies concentrated in Glen Canyon, and Joe's studies concentrated throughout the whole river corridor. So I went along because, you know, they needed a lot of people to help collect and sort. We would sort bugs and algae for hours and hours and hours. And and actually it was funny because so this is my experience in the Blinn lab. You know, like there was a lot of people working in there, and our whole team would go on the river trips. And I feel like we were the hardest working, or one of the, like, we were all business. There weren't drunken brawls on our trips. We were like, because we had to sort until midnight, and we had to get up early and follow a certain schedule because we had to follow the flows. And so we basically collected all day and sorted all night, every day.
It's interesting you should mention this, because the Larry Stevens River trips, the Ted Malice River trips, the Robert Webb River trips out of USGS, the Dean Blinn River trips, I don't ever remember a hint of sexual predation, as it would eventually become into the news and just blow up on the Park Service.
Well, that, let's see.
Did you get us, and before we, because all that's in front of us here, this is 1990, but there, things were morphing, things were changing, not quite yet in the Park Service's own river unit. Did you ever get a sense during that time when you were working on your PhD that was an issue on the river?
No. I mean, people would get silly depending. But that started, so there are all those research river trips with independent scientists or university scientists like Bob Webb, Dean Blinn, Joe Shannon, Jack Schmidt. These are, you know, and but then things changed, in my opinion, drastically when GCES stopped. You know, once the EIS decision was made, I forget what year that was, 90, and it's in my, if you care to read the Grand Canyon monograph, it's all in there.
Good.
But somewhere like 93 or 4 or 6, 96 it changed, because 96 I think was the EIS decision for the moderated flows, I think. And then what with that decision was the dissolution of GCES, and that's when Dave Wegner, Dave Wegner was a sleeper. They thought, oh, this guy, he's soft-spoken, he's gonna be such a pushover at the Bureau of Rec. Like these studies aren't gonna go anywhere. They're gonna just collect a little bit of this and that, and then we're gonna push through our agenda for the dam operations. Well, Dave turned out to be a huge supporter of science and the right thing and conservation and all that stuff. And so at the end of the, I interviewed Dave Wegner, and at the end of the GCES studies, they pretty much were like, you're gonna quit, or we're gonna send you to some other federal place far away from Grand Canyon. Like, you're not gonna continue with Grand Canyon, because you're too outspoken and you're too much pro Grand Canyon River, et cetera, conservation. So, because what they offered him was like a some horrible job in DC or something, he quit and he started his own situation. And so then GCMRC came into play, Grand Canyon Monitoring and Research Center. And I have the mission statement of that, and I saved it when I worked for the park. And I could have thrown it away out of disgust with the whole GCMRC and everything, but that is like a 4-page document that lays out what GCMRC is supposed to be. And it is a part of the USGS, and its mission is to be a small office that receives the, I forget what it was, $20 million from the Bureau of Rec, and to put out RFPs, requests for proposals for research from the outside objective scientific world. And for studies, we need this for the sand, for the ecology, blah, blah, blah. And then take those proposals and evaluate them and award the money. All right? So they're just an office that filters money through and onward to the qualified scientists. Well, GCMRC decided early on that they were going to keep that money and hire their own agency scientists who would be holden to the Bureau of Rec, and the science would be pseudoscience. So
So, Emma, tell me more about this, because when I think of science, I think of peer-reviewed studies, and yet it seemed as though a lot of the science that was done, the example I think of is the sediment collecting at National Canyon, day and night, 24 hours a day, with the dam doing certain flow regimes and all the sediment collections, cooler after cooler full of bottle after bottle full of water samples, and none of that was ever published. If I
Exactly. In
so,
fact, I remember a USGS camp there for months,
yes.
who they stopped at 4 o'clock and started drinking. I mean, what a joke.
So this is the difference between peer-reviewed science and internal science, because I've often wondered about the science center at national parks or the United States Geological Survey, sort of internal studies that don't go out for peer review or the Bureau of Reclamation, that never see the light of day, if the conclusion of the study goes counter to the agency's mission or mandate or direction.
In fact, the reason, like Glen Canyon, because Glen Canyon Environmental Studies was supposed to study the whole canyon. However, it was strictly written in the directions of the mission for the I think that the mission of GCES was, you are not to study anything that will lead to changing dam operations, much less taking the dam down. Those are prohibited. And that's why they even called it Glen Canyon Environmental Studies, because they didn't want them going into Grand Canyon to look at the downstream effects. Yeah, so
Interesting.
they restricted them, and Dave Wegner did as much as he could to widen the studies and to be objective and to look at the real effects. And that's why they wanted to get rid of him.
Okay.
But yeah, so when D and so they wanted to get rid of Dave in the worst way. And so once Dave was out, like a one-man operation show, and they brought in all these other people from USGS. You know, all they saw were dollar signs. Like, look at all the money we could keep in USGS, hire our own scientists, be in control, do what the bureau wants. You know, if you spoke out, and that's another thing. Dean Blinn's lab lost grant funding because we would produce papers that stated this is what's wrong. Like, if you want to preserve this in the canyon or these resources or improve this for the native fish, you have to do this. And it was change the dam operations. And they didn't like that, so they quit giving us grants and they gave them to people who would be yes people to them. So, anyway, that is when the craziness started on the river, where like cases and cases and cases of beer would be, you know, a main stock item for the river trips. Drunkenness, craziness prevailed because I was on those trips. And yeah, it, I mean, and sand was so emphasized, you know, like we know there's no sand, we know 80% of it is gone. But they used this because when I worked for the park and was permitting the trips, they used this to try all kinds of measurement devices. They had this rolling eyeball thing. I mean, they were just pulling in all kinds of different technology just for the purpose of studying. They learned a lot in terms of sand and how to study it by using this. I mean, the answer was the same each and every time, but they were using it as a vehicle for funding to try experiments. But I'm sure there were some good scientists at GCMRC. I'm sure there were. I'm sure there are. But in general, all ending results would never point to that the dam has to be taken down or the flows need to be drastically changed. And things, and there were, it just grew and grew and grew, and things were crazy. Like, it was just like go on the river and get high and get drunk and stuff.
Maybe this is a good place to stop this second part interview, as it's a quarter to three, I'm just thinking there. I have a lot of questions that are starting to come up here at this time frame, sort of as it goes from the Dave Wagner, Glen Canyon environmental studies days with Dean Blinn and the other cooperators, transitioning into the USGS. Controlling this funding that the Park Service couldn't get either, as much as they tried. And I didn't realize that there was that the reclamation was divvying out the dollars to be used for a different purpose. So maybe this is a good time to stop this interview, and we'll pick it up again at this point. Before I push the off button, though, I always want to ask people, is there anything else you're going to want to put in right now because it's important to where we're at? Or is this a
This is a good spot. I had a thought, but I can't think of it, that I wanted to mention about research on the river and GCMRC, but I'll have to see if I can think about it
Okay.
and bring it up.
All right. Well, in that case, this will conclude a part two oral history interview with Emma Beninati. Today is July 17th, 2019. My name is Tom Martin. Thank you so much, Emma.
Thank you.